Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, well, truly a freeform show, but we're going to hear a good portion of an interview with the wonderful and amazing Connie Willis. Stay tuned. To ruin the mood, all you have to do on this blessed computer that we have here, from which I am playing my music, is try to call up an internet browser, or specifically at least Internet Exploder, and it does just that. This is not because of the browser, this is because of the way this machine is set up, and it reboots. So I am terribly sorry, because I'm proud of that music. I'm pleased with that music. And I'm annoyed, very, very annoyed with that. And in order to play much of this morning's show, by the way, I need that machine. I needed to play the interview that we're going to hear, but I was going to look up, a little background information on the recorded interview with this morning's guest. Well, you know what? I'm going to use my little so-called... Nah, if I use my smartphone, I can't even read it. Okay. This morning's dilemma is not a dilemma, really, as Robert was extolling the virtues of WBAI. One of those things is the promise, the premise of freeform radio, and the idea that you can come in here and sort of gauge what the air feels like. And by the air, I mean what is being broadcast and all that good stuff. One second, I have to... Okay, that machine has started coming back up. I have to log into it. System couldn't log you in. Patience, Jim, patience. And I beg your patience as well. Da, 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 da. Done. There we go. Okay, now it's booting up. Anyway, so I have been weighing different things for this morning. I was at a wonderful reading earlier tonight, Carolyn Turgeon and Genevieve Valentine reading at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Series. And Genevieve's new novel is coming out, by the way, in early May. She will be here in April. I don't know everything that's going to be happening on this program in March, but at this point, I can account for almost every... Did I say Saturday? I'm still used to the old ways. Every Wednesday night, Thursday morning in March. But I can account for most of April, and particularly now April 13th, because Robert has donated some of his airtime that night, so that we will broadcast an original radio drama by Ellen Kushner called The Witches of Lublin. That will be on at midnight on the night of April 13th, and then we'll have... The director, I believe, Sue Zizza, and Ellen Kushner, the author, and I think one of the actors, Mr. Timothy Jerome, who's a Tony-nominated actor. I think he's Academy Award nominated, and believe it or not, for all those credits, a board member, former board member of WBAI from years and years ago. He's certainly in our arts department and did a lot of stuff at the BAI Free Music Store. At any rate, we're also going to have Chris Sackmussen on the following week on the 20th. Then the week after that will be Genevieve Valentine. Different things happening. Speaking of readings, yes, I attended this wonderful reading. Oh, yes, the week before that, we're going to celebrate Carol Emshwiller's 90th birthday. She's a wonderful writer, and I'm going to be producing an event at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings on her birthday. She will be there. So, you know, do be there for Carol Emshwiller's 90th birthday. The week before that, April 5th, two readers, Lev Grossman, who is, aside from being a book critic and reviewer of various things and just article writer in general at Time Magazine, is a fantasy writer. His last novel, The Magicians, has done exceedingly well. And the sequel to that, The Magician King, is coming out in November. And Barbara Krasnoff, who is a short story writer, and has been mostly on recording on Hour of the Wolf through the years. So two readings in April, April 5th and April 12th. And I do hope that you will attend both. Admission is free, so there. Okay, so Connie Willis. CapClave is a regional science fiction convention held in Washington, D.C. You can figure out where PhilCon might be held, Balticon, BossCon, BossCon actually, and LayCon, and things like that. But CapClave is like, you know, the capital. It used to be Disclave. There was another convention called Disclave for the District of Columbia, but that sort of exploded. So now there's CapClave instead. And at CapClave, I recorded this three-hour interview with this wonderful, wonderful lady named Connie Willis. Connie has, I don't know how many novels and short stories to her credit. I can tell you that she is one of the most nominated writers in science fiction. And I will, you know, Robert, I tried to, if you even call up a browser on this machine, it just reboots. It did that in the middle of my theme.
What, you know?
So I'm trying to get online to read people a little bit about Connie Willis.
Yeah. I noticed that you call that browser by a different than the usual name. I have a different name for it. The Internet Exploiter.
Now that would be a good thing. Exploiting the Internet. Yeah, Firefox seems to work. They won't let Chrome work. It's blocked.
Really?
And that's my preferred browser. Firefox here, an older version of Firefox works.
What and is this, digital racism?
In a way.
Yeah.
In a way, it really is. It's, not, don't get me started. But the idea that I'm playing music from this, they don't even give you a place to plug in a hard drive at console level, right?
Or a mini, an audio mini input.
Well, that's all I'm asking for. Just a plain old USB port or a mini. Well,
who would think we'd be dealing or with sound around here?
Yeah, exactly. So you literally have to get on your hands and knees. So in order to cue that up, I call up a browser, and boom, it go boom. I'm sorry for complaining on the air this much, people, but hey, what can I say? Okay, now that I've got a browser up, I mean, I can wax eloquently. Okay, here's one thing. One of Connie Willis's most recent works is this. Oh, for Christ's sake. never mind what that was about. It said, yeah, I take a look at her website. I take a look at her website, which is a perfectly simple, benign website. And it says, this site could harm your computer. And I, no, it won't. Sigh. Okay, what am I looking at here? Oh, I didn't know she has a birthday similar to mine. She's born December 31st. I'm born December 30th. Okay, anyway, she has won 10 Hugo Awards and 6 Nebula Awards. Count them. I mean, that's amazing. By the way, Nora Jemison, N.K. Jemison, who was my third guest. Third week. You remember that I brought in this black woman and I told you this is a future great nominated for the Nebula Award 2 weeks ago. Best novel. I called it. I called it. I said it on that show. You said, is that this other woman I told you about? Nalo Hopkinson. It's like, no. This is Nora Jemison.
Oh, you know people.
And I said, Nalo is one of the current greats. This is one of the future greats. And there it is. She is, well, you know, not an old person. She is a second Nebula nomination. First one was for short story, which, you know, she was up against heavy competition. But The 100,000 Kingdoms, her first novel, bingo. Hugo and Nebula. Nebula.
And I think her ancestors were not allowed to read books.
Yeah. Basically, or even owned them, you know, because they were owned. So anyway, Connie Willis is from a different ancestry. Let me see if I can Hugo Awards, Firewatch, The Last of the Winnebagoes. These are short stories or novelettes. The Doomsday Book. Okay, The Doomsday Book is the first of this trilogy that I had mentioned. The first book in this trilogy, The Doomsday Book, are these people at Oxford University that go time traveling for various things, and to make it worthwhile, there's a lot of bells involved, okay? They want a bell from a cathedral that was bombed during World War II. This woman goes back to the time of the Doomsday Book. This is the book that listed all the assets of all the landowners, the gentried people, the landed people in medieval England. And the Doomsday Book listed everything they owned, and it coincides with the time of the plague. So here's this book. It's got some comedic elements, but extremely serious elements. You don't write a semi-realistic book, and yes, good science fiction is always realistic, that takes place during the plague and, well, not killed pretty much everybody off, except for our time-traveling heroine. The second book in that series, all of a sudden, to say nothing of the dog, becomes this incredibly light, brilliant Victorian romp. To the title, to say nothing on the dog, if you've ever heard of Three Men in a Boat, it's sort of a travelogue. One of the first great travelogues by Jerome K. Jerome was actually made into a TV movie by Tom Stoppard, great writer, starring Stephen Fry, Michael Palin, and Tim Curry. Can you imagine that for a trio? So, the name of that book is Three Men and a Boat. The subtitle of it is To Say Nothing of the Dog. Connie's novel is To Say Nothing of the Dog. There is indeed a point when her characters are going up the Thames and encounter Jerome K. Jerome and friends going down the Thames at the same time. And is this amazing romp. And then the big, big finale called All Clear is so big that they published it in two volumes, Blackout and All Clear. And this is actually just in print now. I have not yet the third book. Some of this stuff is just absolutely amazing. She wrote a short story called Even the Queen, which actually refers to menstruation, of all things. This is not like, you know, a young, Connie is born, what year is she born? 1941. So this is not a young maverick type writer, except for the fact that almost everything she writes is so thoroughly original, so thoroughly entertaining, provocative, whether it is one of the most, what's the word, winningest? I hate that. One of the most decorated stories or not. A lot of the stuff that she has written, which are not decorated, are still among my favorites. She has a book, a 1994 novel called Remake, in which you have a character who creates what today we would call mashups, who can simply take a piece from this movie, a character from that movie, can resemble Marilyn Monroe one minute or Cary Grant the next, and actually become these people. It's complicated. You read the novel, you'll understand. And it starts out like a screwball comedy and ends up very thoughtful, very provocative, and serious work. Her story Passage is an amazing work. And I wish that I could just read to you, have her read one of her things, but there isn't time in 90 minutes. But I can play you a portion of an interview. Oh, let me recommend the Doomsday book, or you can actually start with the second book in that series, To Say Nothing of the Dog, or her collection of short stories, The Winds of Marble Arch, which is a collection of different stories. Anyway, Connie was the guest of honor at Capclave. Trying to bring it all together now, right? Last year, last October. And I didn't have an official place in which to interview her. I did a couple of panels with her and all that. But we figured out whose room would we meet? Where would we meet in order to conduct this interview? And I thought, you know what? There's a room sort of in the center where a lot of the gamers go. A lot of the people go to play board games or to just talk to each other or just hang out and all that. And I'm just gonna, whoops, pardon me. I'm just going to commandeer a table and sit down with this person. If people wanted to sit and listen or even ask questions and join us, they're welcome to do it. So we did this twice during the course of the convention. I gathered about 2 hours of material. That and a short story would give me a nice 4 or 5 hour show. We have another hour and 10 minutes. So it's not going to go that way. But what I am going to do is I'm going to play for you the majority of the first session of Connie and I just sitting around and talking. It's really unedited. I edited the very beginning to get past the hi, how are yous and all that and sound checks and so forth. And we come in to the point where the interview actually begins. And this portion should run about 50 minutes, should bring us to, 2:35 or so Eastern Daylight Time. I just realized, of course, I don't have it queued up because the machine rebooted. Okay, but this won't take long. I know where it is. I know where it's buried. Here we go. Double-click that. Yes, I put it right up top. Okay, did it right for a change, Freund, did we? Okay, good. And so, without much further ado, let me begin that interview and say, okay, so you're going to be hearing the middle of the day, in the middle of a science fiction convention with all the people around us just coming by, but I've got this neat little recorder. Robert, if you're listening, this is that recorder I was telling you about off air last week. There's a tiny little thing, and you'll hear the sound quality even with all the people around us. I'll loan you mine. You ought to try it. Anyway, So here then, we set our Wayback Machine to October 23rd of last year to Capclave, and we will speak with Connie Willis. The last time that I interviewed you formally was at the last time the Nebulas were in New York.
Okay.
I think it was 2007.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I found that the way to get a wonderful interview out of you is to say something incendiary.
Oh,
and
okay.
That time I simply noted that I think Busby Berkeley choreography is dancing.
Uh-huh.
Contrary to what I read in Remake.
Right.
And that set you off. So I have to find a different thing.
Right.
Now.
Yeah.
To set me off. Yeah, last night I threw one at you just at the very end of the panel, knowing that I couldn't get a rebuttal, which was that Margaret Rutherford was my favorite Miss Marple.
I know, and she's not really the best Miss Marple. She's okay. She's too large. She's too large. The whole point of Miss Marple is that she's small and fluffy looking and sits in the corner and nobody pays any attention to her. And Margaret Rutherford's just too jolly and hearty and large, I think, to fit that pattern. I like her. I like her Miss Marple. I like all the Miss Marples, but my favorite is... Now I won't be able to. Joan Hickson, who did the
which
long
is so funny because I was
series.
Watching in passing Murder, She Said, and Joan Hickson is in it.
Oh, really?
Yes,
she is.
Yes,
really?
And she might play a Scullery maid or
something. Oh wow! Well, I love.
But she's
her.
In the opening credits.
Yeah.
So she had more than five lines.
Right. So I love her and. And of course, none of them really capture the true Miss Marple, the image that I have in my head, which is why I like reading rather than, you know, watching things, because the image that you create in your head is always so much better than anything somebody can create for you.
Why is Miss Marple important to you, and how does it relate to your books?
Well, I love Miss Marple because she is overlooked and considered insignificant, and people underestimate her constantly, as people frequently underestimate others. We are very much an appearance versus reality society, and I guess all societies are that way, but our society seems exceptionally bad in that regard, in that we're constantly into marketing and bluster, and whoever is the loudest and whoever says they're the most important is the most important, and so on. And I think we're constantly underestimating people, and I frequently have characters in my books who meet that qualification. They're
not presidents of galaxies.
They aren't, and they're the kind of people that other people overlook. They don't appreciate them. So, which is why my heroes are so often not the handsome leading man type, but the kind of quiet scientist or the earnest young man, or the, you know, Jimmy Stewart is the hero of a lot of my stories, if people don't recognize him. I have always thought of myself a little bit as Miss Marple, because I have this image of, you know, the little housewife from the Midwest, and was told, in fact, by a famous science fiction writer very early in my career that I should really go back to the kitchen where I belonged.
Ooh, I have to ask who.
I'm not going to tell. I'm not going to say.
Maybe if you could write it down for me and I can...
No, I wouldn't do that to
okay.
him. But, you know, this tendency to underestimate women, of course, that's a problem women have generally. But to underestimate somebody who's a housewife, to underestimate somebody who's from the Midwest, and I had all of those things. And I always thought it was a great advantage, because nobody was paying any attention to me, and nobody was taking me seriously or thought I was important enough to look at, and so I was able to observe all kinds of great stuff. It's kind of like Jane Austen standing in the corner, you know, and she looks harmless, but she's really not harmless. And it gives you a position of, you know, of power. But it's not always a good place to be. I hate that science fiction is overlooked and underestimated, and I hate that I have to spend half the time that I'm doing speeches and stuff defending the fact that I write science fiction and defending it as a field, because I don't think it needs any defense. I think it's a wonderful place to be, and it's serious fiction, and that you shouldn't have to defend. On the other hand, you can get away with murder if you're not noticed. And so I guess that's what science fiction is doing, is getting away with murder. To a large extent, yeah. Yeah, so.
It's a sad thing that still to this day, a few things happen. Number one is that if you're writing a really great science fiction book, the agents or editors will often say,
right, this isn't really science fiction.
Well, one of the things that I heard an agent I know say constantly is, can this be a crossover?
Right.
Can we sell this at mainstream?
Right.
I don't mind if it's science fiction.
Right, but
that's
right.
Like, okay for you,
right,
the
right.
writer on the
right.
head. But
right.
can we sell this?
Right.
As mainstream, because that way he can, well, of course,
yeah.
the price difference
right.
is this way he can sell it to Knopf instead
right.
of to Tor.
Right. But the thing that's really discouraging is that at great expense and time, I will manage to get a book group to read the book, and they'll really like it. But then they'll say, and I'll think, oh, good, I'm making inroads for science fiction. And then they'll say, but it isn't really science fiction. We all liked it, but it isn't science fiction. I'm like, why isn't it science fiction? It has time travel in it. And they'll say, because we liked it.
Yes.
And therefore, it can't possibly be, because we don't like science fiction, ergo, anything that we like isn't science fiction.
And Socrates is a cat.
Exactly. That's right. It's so discouraging. And I love science fiction. I've loved it from the moment I started writing. I've never thought of writing anything else. But people constantly say, so when are you going to write something serious? Or when are you going to break into the big time? Or when are you going to... I'm like, you don't understand. This is where I want to be. This is... And I... To please the science fiction audience is to please the most intelligent and discerning audience out there. So why would I want to go anyplace else? You know, but...
Money. But...
Money is... pointless. As Hatter would say, sci-fi's Alice, pointless. Pieces of paper, pointless. And I totally agree with him, so.
I'm just thinking that this is ridiculous, because we could have and might have had this exact discussion 30 years ago.
Right.
And
right. Nothing has improved. We've permeated the entire society. Every car commercial is science fiction. Every major movie is science fiction. And yet we're still forced into defending the field.
Yeah. So 30 years ago, it was... 40 years ago, was that Star Trek stuff.
Right.
Before that, it was that Buck Rogers stuff.
Exactly.
Then it became that Star Wars stuff. And now it's...
That Harry Potter stuff.
the Harry Potter stuff and or anything that was seen at Comic-Con.
Right, right.
Except that they're releasing all films at Comic-Con,
right.
They don't have to have anything to do
exactly.
with comics or science
exactly.
fiction or fantasy.
But you know, then I think of alternate realities, and an alternate reality in which we were taken seriously by academia. This is not a good thing either. This is the worst thing. That, you know, Dashiell Hammett was ruined by the fact that he was picked up by the literati. You know, when
yeah.
he started hanging around with Lillian Hellman and started taking himself too seriously. So I guess on balance, I would prefer that 200 years from now, they figure out that we were writing great literature.
Okay.
Than for them to figure it out now. Because once they did, we'd be fighting at pen meetings and the National Book Award. And we all know what those people are like. They're horrible people. And they apparently eat each other alive. So maybe we're better off in this nice little corner, you know, of the world. Maybe. But I would love, and what I try to do a lot of times when I'm speaking to groups outside the field, is I'll talk about some of my favorite science fiction stories, like Bob Shaw's The Light of Other Days, which I think is a perfect science fiction story.
Oh my God, I haven't read that in years. I have to reread it.
It's a beautiful story. And Ted Sturgeon's The Man Who Lost the Sea. Things like that should be in every Norton anthology, you know. Not
yeah.
the Norton anthology of science fiction, the Norton anthology.
Yeah.
And they're not. And they're forgotten by large numbers of people. But then life is not fair.
Yeah.
So.
Then again, take a look at the table of contents in which you are included of the Wesleyan anthology.
Yeah.
And of science fiction.
Yeah.
And that is, what a wonderful book.
Yeah. I mean, I think people will find us. I found science fiction, and I didn't have any connections to science fiction. I didn't know there was such a thing. And so if I could find you, anybody could find you. And
so let's ask an interview question. So, how did you find science fiction?
Well,
I
was 13, and which is supposed to be the golden age of science fiction. And I loved all, I mean, I read everything I could get my hands on up to that point. And I read, you know, I was in love with girls' books like Anne of Green Gables and Little Women and all those books. And I, at one point, I decided to do what Francie, who's the heroine of Tree Grows in Brooklyn, had done, which was to read the entire fiction shelves alphabetically. And I made it all the way to the D's before I stopped, because at that point I had discovered science fiction. But so I just read everything I could get my hands on. And I, like most readers who are truly addicted, I read stuff that was way over my head and out of my league and only half understood it when I read it. But so what? It was still great stuff. And
I think a lot of science fiction readers did that.
Yes.
You're always reaching up and
you're always
looking for that next rung.
Right. You're not reading at your age level thing. And I think you're reading at your age level is a stupid idea. I think you read at whatever you're ready for. And like a lot of books, like I read Peter DeVries's, he was a D, yeah, he made it to the D's. And I read his Blood of the Lamb, which is a truly adult novel about a man whose son dies of a leukemia. I was not really able to get everything out of that book, but I remembered it very fondly. And then when I was old enough to really read it, you know, I went back and read it, and it's a wonderful book.
Really?
And I never would have discovered it had I not tried to read it when I was 13. But anyway, so I was shelving books in the school library and picked up this book that I thought looked interesting, which was Have Space, It Will Travel by Heinlein, and it was the yellow library copy with the guy in the spacesuit on the cover.
Okay.
And which I can still see to this day. Well, I own a copy now, but and it was just, I picked it up and I opened it and I started reading, and it was just magic. It was just, I was totally hooked within like 3 pages. I was hooked forever. It was love at first sight. And
it's amazing how many women Heinlein brought into science fiction.
I know, and I'm not a person who believes in love at first sight, but I fell in love at first sight with that book. And it was funny. It was literary. I mean, the fact that his dad is reading Three Men in a Boat, you know, is...
That's right.
He is. And The Tempest is how they save the world. They quote The Tempest.
Yes.
And that's their defense of Earth.
I had totally forgotten the Jerome K. Jerome connection.
Yeah. Oh, so God. It's a really literary book. It's funny. It's full of adventure. It has a romantic comedy in it, even though she's only 10 years old. But as she says, she will be quite a dish in 10 years.
Yes, that's the Heinlein thing.
Yeah, well, no, but it's a charming thing. It's a child's wish fulfillment thing, too.
The Podcane of Mars has a little of that in it, and so forth. Yeah.
And so I just fell in love with it. And then we didn't have, there was no such thing in those days as a science fiction section, you know, in the library. So, but these books all had the little spine.
If there were, they would have thrown them out.
Right. But they had the little on the spine. They had the atom and the spaceship symbol.
Right.
So I went
yes.
through the entire library looking for the atom and spaceship symbol, because I didn't know any of the authors or anything. And then found, you know, Asimov and Clark and Bradbury and the whole gang. But I really don't feel, I mean, I did fall in love at first sight. But truly, I think what turned it from a love affair into a lifelong marriage was they had a complete set of the Year's Best anthologies written by or edited by Anthony Boucher and Judith Merrill who's the other one? Robert P. Mills.
Yes.
And those collections were, oh my God, astonishing.
That's what I lived
They're
for.
They're astonishing because you've got these brilliant writers all side by side in the same book. You've got Zena Henderson and Shirley Jackson and Theodore Sturgeon and Frederick Brown and
Kornbluth.
And Kornbluth and James Blish. Excuse me, my husband is here. And all these different people writing like all across the spectrum of what this story could be. You know, you have the joke story, you've got the very witty, funny story, you've got really serious, heartbreaking stories, you've got the twist endings, you've got the Philip K. Dick stories that make you question your own view of reality, or if there is a reality.
That's about 10 years later.
Yeah, well, true, but But and yeah. You've just got all these stories that are so amazing, and stories by legitimate writers like John Collier and Shirley Jackson,
mm-hmm.
and then stories,
especially in the Judith Merrill books,
right?
Where
right.
she was trying to
expand the field.
Yeah,
and then you've got stories by these, I would say, professional writers or hack writers who are churning out stories for the Western magazines and Black Mask and everything else, like Frederick Brown, and they're wonderful in a totally different way. And they're just people writing at the top of their game. And I was just blown away by all of the things you could do. All that, like, here is a place that I can tell basically any story I want, because I could use this model and tell this story, or this model and tell this story. And I just fell in love with it. I think it's an amazing field. And I'm just, you know, I'm proud to be part of it, so...
But at the time that you were reading all these wonderful masters and all this fabulous stuff, did it impart to you, because there's one thing that they have in common, they all shared a particular type of chromosome. They're all men.
Did they...
Except
they
for
weren't
everybody
all men. Went. They weren't all men. Zanna Henderson is not a...
Right,
Shirley
right.
Jackson, Kit Reed... You know, that
Kit,
was
well, Kit Reed again,
that was
like
the,
10 years
the
later,
interesting
yeah.
thing to
yeah,
me.
Yeah, you're right.
The interesting
with
thing to names. Me was people would say, "So how did you decide to storm the barricades of science fiction when there were no women in it?" I'm like, "It never occurred to me that there were no women in it. I was reading women, and I thought that the field had women in it, and I never felt."
And especially in the Judith Merrill books, because she'd be looking for that.
Right. Well, and she was. And the editor was a woman. So
yeah.
It never occurred to me that it wasn't an integrated society. But on the other hand, it didn't feel... it is true that girls growing up in the 50s, they had to relate to the male heroes because there was nobody else to relate to mm-hmm. in fiction. And so you just related to those people. I always relate to the main character, and I